They're saying, no, we don't have to go through government because we don't want them to take the aid and do whatever they want with it, give it to their own people. We want the organizations that are helping to come and give us the aid directly. That's one thing. And the second observation,
we have 20 seconds, Stefan.
Yes, in contrast to 2010, there has been little international presence. Haitians have really been getting help from other local organizations. It's mostly been a thing where brothers and sisters are helping each other so far. So the focus needs to be put on the outskirts of the South Department.
Stefan Vincent, I want to thank you so much for being with us, a Haitian citizen journalist helping to cover the Haiti earthquake for the BBC. We'll link to your piece, The Forgotten Villages Cut Off from Help. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. It's 7:59. Next up, we have Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
And good morning, everybody out there. This is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. A couple weeks, we're coming up on our fall membership drive, but we always look for your support. Please go to kboo.fm and check out our website. And while you're there, feel free to click on the donate button and send us some resources. We are looking to buy a new the transmitter that transmits from the station to the big antenna, and and other things. Anyway, this is a valuable community resource now more than ever, so help us out if you can. So, I calling from my home here in Montevilla again, not coming to the station. Partly I had a little computer trouble there last week, but also I may have let down my guard a little bit this past weekend. I went to a gathering of old friends and comrades outside, completely outside, and you know, mostly socially distanced, but there were moments where people were congregating, and it's the Delta variant is, this COVID pandemic is not over, as we all know, hopefully. The Delta variant is amping up. People are saying now it may crest in a couple weeks, but we don't know that. So we can't let our guard down. We've come this far, folks. Let's keep it going. And so anyway, I'm just kind of playing a little safe, and hope you are too. Please mask up. Now we have the outdoor mask mandate again. I know we're all very tired of this, but hey, we don't have massive earthquakes and devastation like Haiti is suffering. We don't have some of the major impacts of climate change like other parts of the world and the United States, just not too far from us, even with the massive wildfires going on. And who knows what the fall will bring anyway. So I just want to just put that out there. please continue to be safe. We need all of us to continue to struggle for what we can in the midst of the mayhem. And so, yeah, a little news from the climate change front before I get into the subject, main subject of today. I'm by myself, so you're welcome to call in 503-231-8187. So, yeah, rain fell on the peak of Greenland's ice sheet for the first time in recorded history. The planet continues to experience the worst heat on record. 2021 seems destined to breaking yet another global temperature record. Records continue to be broken, most recently in Iceland for the day yesterday, possibly today as well. Worst wildfires on record. The mega drought continues in the western United States, although we did have that blessed rain just the other day. Was everybody else sort of kind of laughing out loud and doing a little jig? Even though really for Portland, it really wasn't that much of a rain, but boy, it was a relief. And of course, the cool temperatures at night got down to what, 48 or something like that the other day. Anyway, yeah, we got to take heart from what we can day by day. And as I said, continue to fight, continue to struggle. Yeah, the Klamath Basin is looking grimmer. In addition to farmers and ranchers, wells going dry, and some houses are now losing water. So, you know, we can sort of gloss the contradictions since we have these massive irrigation systems in the in the Colorado Basin, in the Klamath Basin, other places that continue to suck water. They're having to actually stop outflow from is it Lake Powell? I can't be right. Anyway, please help me out. I had that, but yeah, and there's going to be increasing competition between, you know, urban areas and rural areas. So that urban-rural divide is going to get starker due to climate change as the effects, especially of this drought, continue to manifest themselves. Are we going to have more open conflicts? As I said a couple weeks ago, with my co-host Jacqueline Keeler, that the camp out set up at the head of the irrigation channel from the Klamath Lake that was abandoned due to basically lack of support from the local ranchers and farmers, especially some of the leadership, just didn't want to get into a huge Malheur refuge type open war. So that's good, but will things like that start cropping up again there and elsewhere? Big questions. Yeah, so in the midst of all this mayhem between the COVID and the Delta variant, its Delta variant and ongoing climate change, we've got the far right extremists continuing to raise mayhem, especially here in Portland, including the Proud Boys, led by the Proud Boys, basically, who are sort of adjuncts to Joey Gibson and his Patriot Prayer Group. They seem to be kind of leading the charge. They were always kind of like the most shock troops. So yeah, on Sunday, I don't know if any were there, far groups gathered Sunday. This is from an OPB article of a couple days ago. Gunfire erupts after Proud Boys and anti-fascists openly brawl in Portland without police intervention. What else is new? And of course, Ted Wheeler is calling it a success, the lack of police intervention. Anyway, far-right group studying in Portland for an event they called the Summer of Love, even as the rally date was chosen to commemorate an extraordinary violent clash last summer in the city, right here. I was at that one. Boy, the bear spray was flying fast and furious. and the fireworks and everything else. So this event ended with a roving brawl along busy city streets in the Park Rose neighborhood, not far from me, and shots being fired in downtown Portland. No one was reported injured in the shooting incident. The two sides, anti-fascists and far-left demonstrators, gathered downtown earlier in the day to oppose the far-right gathering. The two sides eventually clashed in northeast Portland after remaining separate for hours, leaving a spree of violence that stretched blocks. Yeah, so that goes on. You can read about that. I'm sure you've read something about that. So, yeah, I want to talk about Proud Boys and white nationalists and Christian nationalists. I wanted to have Professor Mark Juergensmeyer on. He is actually away in Hawaii, so he couldn't do it today. He's going to be on next week. He's a University of California, Santa Barbara professor of sociology, global studies, and religious studies. And he focuses on the rise of religious violence around the world. So we're kind of going to talk about, you know, religious extremism from the Taliban to the Proud Boys, something like that. But I kind of, since I'd sort of prepared for that as a show, and it bears going in depth into, I kind of want to take it from a few angles before we get into it next week. So there's a article I wanted to read from by Philip Gorski, White Christian Nationalism, The Deep Story Behind the Capitol Insurrection. Let's see. Oh, I'll just read from the start and skip a little bit and get to the section I really wanted to, and then we can invite callers at 503-231-8187. This is from the Georgetown University Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. As one observer noted, the January 6th protesters, remember that, seemed a motley crew: country club Republicans, well-dressed social conservatives, and white evangelicals in Jesus caps, shoulder to shoulder with QAnon cultists, Second Amendment cosplay commandos, and doughy hardcore white nationalists. One group erected a giant cross, another a wooden gallows. Someone waved a Jesus Saves banner, while another sported a Camp Auschwitz hoodie. But the closer you look, the murkier things become. Christians waved Trump flags. The Proud Boys kneeled and prayed. One man, decked out as a cosplay crusader, clutched a large leather Bible to his chest with skeleton gloves. What looked like apples and oranges turned out to be a fruit cocktail, white Christian nationalism. White Christian Nationalism, WCN, is, first of all, a story about America. It says America was founded as a Christian nation by white Christians, and its laws and institutions are based on biblical, that is, Protestant Christianity. This much is certain, though. America is divinely favored, whence its enormous wealth and power. In exchange for these blessings, America has been given a mission to spread religion, freedom, and civilization by force if necessary. But that mission is endangered by the growing presence of non-whites, non-Christians, and non-Americans on American soil. White Christians must therefore, quote, take back the country, their country. White Christian nationalism is not just a story, it's also a political vision. Violence and racial purity are central to that vision, as Samuel Perry and Andrew Whitehead have shown. White Christian nationalists tend to favor a strong military and capital punishment, oppose gun control. WCN is thus strongly correlated with opposition to interracial marriage, non-white immigration, and affirmative action. To understand how American Christianity became so entangled with racism and violence, we first have to trace it back to its scriptural roots. I know this is I'm going to break in here. I know this is, you know, quite possibly, probably familiar stuff to you, but I think taking these deep dives into our historical roots, I think is, you know, despite the dire nature of the current moment, I think is a good idea, because it really helps us understand what the true nature of the especially the far right extremists, what their roots are. So these roots are dual, the scriptural roots. It turns out white Christian nationalism is not just one story, but two. The first is a promised land story. The New England Puritans saw themselves as the heirs of the biblical Israelites. They imagined themselves as a chosen people, and they came to see the New World as their promised land, as in New England. And as their relationship with the natives shifted from curiosity to hostility, they began to see the Indians as Canaanites who had to be conquered. I'm going to break in again. I don't know if y'all have, any of you watched that Jerusalem series on CNN, but my eyes were open. I didn't realize the, you know, the story of the original taking of Jerusalem from, it was either the Canaanites or actually another group, I think, that was indigenous to that area. And so, you know, the idea that all of Israel is actually, you know, is actually historically Jewish, it's a lot more complicated. There's a very, very complicated history there. But anyway, I'll just leave that as an aside. So they began to see the Indians as Canaanites who had to be conquered. The second story is an end time story. So we've got the Promised Land story and we've got the end time story. Most Christian theologians read Revelation in allegorical terms as a depiction of the moral struggles within the believer's heart, but some interpret the text more literally as a description of bloody struggles to come. That is how many Puritan radicals read it, and they exported those ideas to New England. The two stories gradually fused together during the Puritans' wars with the Indians. Cotton Mather came to believe that the New World would be the central battlefield in the final struggle between good and evil. He placed himself and his brethren on the side of the good, and the Catholic French and their native allies on the side of evil. He likened the natives to demons and viewed the killing of the natives as a blood sacrifice to an angry God. It was war that welded Protestantism and Englishness together in the New World. And then he talks about how Protestantism and Englishness got entangled with whiteness. Well, let me just read that. I know I've gone over this a lot with Jacqueline Keeler. To answer that question, we need to shift our focus to Virginia. There and elsewhere, the most common justification for the enslavement of kidnapped Indians and Africans was that they were heathens. But this argument broke down in the late 17th century as some enslaved persons converted to Christianity and some white Christians sought to evangelize them. The problem was initially resolved by shifting the legal basis of slavery from religion to color. Blacks could be slaves, whites could not. It was then more fully resolved by creating a new theological basis for slavery. Perhaps the most influential was the curse of Ham. Blacks were the descendants of Noah's son, Ham, the argument went, and their color enslavement were a result of the curse that Noah had called down on their head. Anyway, it's a lengthy article, and so he goes on, white Christian nationalism is what linguist George Lakoff calls a frame. A frame is like a bare-bones movie script. It has, quote, has roles like a cast of characters, relations between the roles, and scenarios carried out by those playing the roles. Like a movie, it can be made and remade with new actors and modified scenarios. The, quote, frontiersman becomes a, quote, Indian fighter, and then a, quote, cowboy. And, of course, now, you know, whatever, QAnon, Trumpist, Proud Boy, you name it. The scene shifts from Appalachia to Kentucky to Wyoming. Trumpism is, among other things, the latest version of the white Christian nationalist frame. Echoing the Promised Land story, Trump says he will, quote, take back the country from the outsiders and invaders who have taken control, immigrants and secularists, Muslims and Mexicans, and then restore it to its rightful owners. So yeah, this is a script that the Proud Boys, you know, the Western chauvinists carry out, and you know, the whole war against racial theory, you know, the big bugaboo. Sorry, as a talk show host, you should have these things right at the top of your head. It'll come back to me, or someone can call in at 503-231. Oh, critical race theory. There you go, critical race theory, which basically is just what I just read, and more. I mean, this is coming from, you know, a white academic perspective, but I think, you know, most people of color scholars are covering a lot of the same ground, but then also, you know, from their own personal experience, which counts for a lot. Okay, so I've kind of set the stage there. You know, I have some other things I'd like to read from if no one calls in, but That's what I want to talk about. What do you want to talk about? 503-231-8187 is the number to call in. Again, there's a lot of stuff that's come out on this. It's kind of, you know, with the obviously post January 6th, there's a lot of articles in the immediate aftermath of that. Now, with the continued presence, you know, and so escalation of tactics by the Proud Boys and their cohorts, including joining up, excuse me, with the anti-vaccine, the right-wing anti-vaccine crusade, like in Southern California, and creating mayhem around that. They're, you know, they're opportunists. They kind of glom on to whatever is the going thing, and to advance their basically right-wing street fighting agenda. So, yeah, so this article is, well, actually, I want to find that one on the with the on the Southern California with the right-wing anti-vaccination. Anyway, there's a lot of resources. Here's another article for Insurrectionists, a violent faith brewed from nationalism, conspiracies, and Jesus. That's from the Religion News Service from back on January 12th. Says a lot of the same things, doesn't have a as deep a historical perspective as Philip Gorski that I just read from. But they quote some, you know, some other important people who are following on this. Andrew Whitehead, co-author of the book Taking America Back for God, Christian Nationalism in the United States. Talks about that. Here, let me go back to this article, because there's some people in Portland who had who were organizing against them. Pardon me, I'm just looking around here for that article. Came out on a Truth Out just recently. I guess I didn't put that in my. So let me just look that up for a second here. As I once again invite you to call up at 503-231-8187. Here we go. Antifa, anti-fascist, stop Proud Boys from entering Portland City Center on Sunday. I did reach out to one group, but I did it kind of at the last minute, so I don't expect them to. Maybe someone's listening in and could call up. The far-right Proud Boys haven't stopped holding rallies in progressive urban areas, but their ability to draw crowds and take over city centers is being checked by anti-fascists looking to halt their growth. On Sunday, a number of people associated with the far-right Patriot movement held a rally in Portland, Oregon, featuring the Proud Boys, members of Patriot Prayer, and unaffiliated supporters. One of its key organizers was Audra Price, a member of the Pacific Northwest-based, quote, police supporters group known as Cops Northwest, which organizes anti-Black Lives Matter rallies. Some of the organizations associated with the far-right rallies, such as the Proud Boys, are at the core of the recent spate of far-right violence that has plagued both Portland and other cities around the country. As expected, numerous organizations and autonomous organizers prepared a series of interventions to challenge the far-right rally, refusing to let the far-right activists return to the city without objection. This is by Shane Burley, published just yesterday in Truth Out. This clash between the far-right and anti-fascist comes exactly a year after another clash in which Proud Boys and other far-right groups rallied on the steps of the Justice Center in Portland in an effort to challenge the Black Lives Matter groups that had been demonstrating there throughout the summer. On that day, police stood blocks away, refusing to intervene, as projectiles were hurled at anti-racist protesters and guns were drawn on unarmed activists. Since 2016, far-right groups have headed into Portland and other liberal cities attempting to instigate conflict that would allow them to push a narrative about protecting the cities from allegedly violent left-wing protesters. part of the goal for anti-fascist and anti-racist organizations' advance of the Proud Boy rally was to make such a public call for anti-fascist demonstrations and attention that the right, far right would back down from their attempt to enter the middle of the city. On Friday, August 20, a coalition of a number of groups, including Don't Shoot Portland, Interfaith Clergy Resistance, and the Oregon Justice Resource Center, held a press conference in front of the city hall in an effort to draw attention to the fact that far-right groups were again making Portland a target. Juan Chavez of the Oregon Justice Center, who also said, "We're concerned community people who are sick and tired of the city's silence on these issues, of Proud Boys coming and running roughshod over our city." He also mentioned that just 2 weeks prior, weapons were pulled on protesters during a far-right rally. This quote, Juan Chavez continued, "The solutions to this aren't necessarily complicated. We're just gravitated towards seeing the challenging of police authority as a greater sin than driving through a city with a Trump flag shooting at people." Many anti-racist activists allege that the police are unwilling to take action against far-right demonstrators who often come from out of the city, are armed, and often publicly state their intent to commit violence. Instances like last year's clashes saw police refusing to intervene against far-right attacks or using disproportionate violence against the anti-fascist demonstrators. Earlier reports suggested the police view the right-wing demonstrators as, quote, more mainstream, and this could explain their responses. Well, I would add that I would suggest they were... they tend to be more politically in resonance with them. The same day, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler held a press conference begging Portlanders to stay home, just as he had done in 2019 when anti-fascists planned to turn out in fierce opposition to a Proud Boys summer rally. And it goes on, and that's again from Truth Out yesterday. So, yeah, those are some of the things that I said I would like to talk about. Oh, looks like we do have a caller. Hope you haven't been waiting too long, Jeremy, but go ahead. If you're there, you're on the air.
Well, just as a – let me turn off the radio. Just as a heads up, I was – the phone was ringing for 2 minutes, and then I gave up and called back, and then it rang for about a minute until finally they picked up. So something's going wrong in the control room or wherever.
Okay.
Anyway, if you want callers, you got one. So, for years, I've always felt that the word fascist, crypto-fascist, all the F words were grotesquely misused, overused, used by people who haven't read, you know, more than a couple of paragraphs, much less a few books about the actual history of fascism. And I no longer have to correct people because there is something fascist going on, and I'm terrified. What I was taught when I was a Trotskyist, and the only thing I didn't unlearn, is there's no free speech for fascists. That's how they build their movement. The question, how do you go about restricting their ability to, you know, enthrall tortured, sad, miserable people into killing the rest of us? And I don't know how to do it. Hello?
Yeah, no, I'm here. I'm listening.
Hello?
To you.
Oh, that's great.
Hello? Yeah, I'm listening to you. I don't know why he didn't hear me. Oh, well. Hopefully that's not a serious technical issue. If my board operator can let me know on Facebook if there's something going on. He hung up. I was listening. I think you all out there were listening. Yes, I mean, that's a big question. Obviously, what is known as Antifa, which is more or less a loose-knit group of similar-thinking people who believe that, I guess, the main, if not the only thing, but the main thing they have in common is a belief that the best and or only way to counteract the rise of a fascist movement as it's trying to establish itself through street violence, is to counteract them on the streets. That's the reasoning behind Antifa as I know it. There's obviously political, ideological commonalities. I think they're probably not, it's not as unified as maybe the right-wingers would like to think. I think, you know, because, you know, you have to be basically, you know, you kind of have to be physically fit. You kind of have to have, you know, your wits, quick thinking on your feet, ability, a lot of things that a lot of us either no longer have or haven't had in our lives, to the extent that you want to go out there and actually engage directly. I mean, you know, you can be behind the scenes and contribute. You know, I don't want to scare people off, because it's, you know, you generally speaking, you have to put yourself in harm's way to be in danger at those, you know, things can shift quickly. You know, you certainly can get tear gas, pepper spray, bear spray as the wind shifts, or if you're too close to it. You know, people can randomly come after people, you know, but it does help to be, you know, physically fit and able to, you know, to move quickly and such. So, yeah, I mean, there is a certain amount of privilege, if you will, certainly physical privilege that goes along with being involved in Antifa. So, you know, it's not for everybody, but that caveat said, you know, people can contribute in a lot of different ways. People bring food, people, you know, can express their political support, not marginalize them, etc. But as far as fighting fascists in the streets, it's not necessarily for everybody, but there are a lot of people who can participate. And okay, looks like Jeremy's back. So I don't know if why you couldn't hear me before, but you're back on the air now.
Anyway, it could be my phone, which is all of one day in my under my ownership. Anyway, okay. Anyone else has an old phone or wants to? Anyway, it's called Backtrack. What an amazing website. Anyway, hopefully the phone is not my phone. Hopefully it's your fault, not my phone's fault. Anyway, I have a few things to say about my experience as a 60, then probably 66-year-old. I'm turning 69, so I've gone to most of the demos until. I think it was last time I've actually lost track, and I'm not real pleased with my so-called comrades. There seem to be, as there has been in the 50 plus years I've been going to demonstrations, a lot of incoherent, well, it's only semi-coherent adolescent testosterone poisoning, which can occur in people in their 40s. I'd like to think I never did any of that. I threw a rock once in Wisconsin and felt bad afterwards. I'm no pacifist, but any 19-year-old masked up in black smoking a cigarette through his bandana, that drove me nuts. You know, I used to smoke 4 packs a day. I can't be around it, and they were all real rude about that.
Okay, we got to let you go. We got to let you go. I hope.
I got it.
We got to let you go. I hope our board operator caught that. You can't do that on the air. You ought to know that by now. You've called in. You've heard that. Everybody knows. I mean, anyway, so I assume that my board operator, Ty, pushed the dump button and cut that off. And I just want to admonish people to watch their language. On the air, please, you can't say the 7 bad words, which, of course, I won't do as George Carlin does and say them for you right now, because I can't. You know, there's just like, for better or worse, I think it's for worse. I don't agree with the FCC's, you know, someday that will be challenged. But, you know, I don't know. I think cussing a lot in public is, I don't know, not that great a thing. But anyway, whatever. So just be careful. So, Jeremy, sorry we had to let you go. But the number is 503-231-8187. He was also going a little bit off topic. Please, someone who was there, please call in on Sunday, 503-231-8187. Or anybody else who wants to talk about this and the ongoing clash between fascists and anti-fascists. Yeah, I have my own criticisms of the self-proclaimed Antifa, anti-fascists. I do think that, I personally think that those nightly demonstrations just kind of basically kept repeating themselves over and over again. I didn't see a lot of kind of growth in tactics and strategy. I just saw maybe just more escalation towards arson and increased, you know, breaking of windows, which, you know, I'd like to see, you know, more strategic and more creative actions that sort of develops. I'd like to see better propaganda. I'd like to see some broadsides, some published material, you know, some street newspapers, you know, some anti-fascist street newspapers, broadsides and flyers, which there are some of, but, you know, we seem to have kind of lost that culture of, you know, all those different elements together. So I don't know. Those are some things I think of, but you probably don't want to just hear me. I'd like to hear what you have to say. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're already halfway through the show, and I've been talking about white Christian nationalism. I read from an article by Philip Gorski, White Christian Nationalism, the Deep Story Behind the Capitol Insurrection, and, you know, between the Proud Boys and the Patriot Prayer. They all, you know, I've talked to some of them. They believe that, yeah, they believe that the culture wars, you know, that their side is right, you know, that there's one monolithic view of American history, that basically the colonists, the European colonists had a cultural superiority, that other people had to make way, you know, that slavery wasn't so bad, that, you know, that really, yeah, that white European culture is, you know, the highest fruit of what the earth has had to offer, that women should stay in their place, you know, on and on. And, you know, frankly, they're wrong, and they've been proved wrong by the better scholarship, you know, that they're at war with, you know, the People's History of the United States type of history. You know, it does have some errors. It does simplify a little bit, but basically it's the sort of the political framework that they disagree with, rather than any particular facts thrown out in that book and others like it. Oh, we do have a person. My Facebook feed sometimes makes it difficult for me to see the next post from my board operator, Ty. But we do have Kathy on the line. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. I just happened to find your station, and I heard what you were talking about, and so I wanted to call in. I wasn't there on Sunday, but can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't there on Sunday, but I wanted to just call in and kind of give my thoughts on the two sides that are clashing.
Uh-huh.
So I spent about 7, 8, I don't know, maybe 9 months trying to figure out what was going on between the two sides, because they weren't making sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I have come to a conclusion that they're both very misunderstood, and that if we would just take the time to sit down and communicate, learn how to communicate with each other, we might be able to, I don't know if we if you'd want to call it unity necessarily, but to call Antifa anti-fascist, I find is almost offensive.
Really?
They're not anti-fascist. And to call the right wing extremist and white supremacist is offensive also, because they're not everyone's like that. And we have to quit clumping everybody into one big, huge group on each side.
So what's fascism to you?
So fascism is like authoritarian control. It's a form of of control coming down from the government that says, well, I mean, the ultimate is, you know, I'm going to kill you for these beliefs. Like,
well, you know, the fascist regimes were, you know, the Franco regime in Spain, the Mussolini regime in Italy, and
right.
The Nazis. The Nazis were somewhat different, but those were the known fascist regimes. Then there, you know, there's some in Latin America that were pretty much fascist.
Right.
So what characterized those regimes that might be people might see as a danger in the, you know, the Trump supporting right wing?
Well, I think that there's a lot of misguided information out there. Like I'm going to be honest, I voted for Trump, but I'm not thinking that he's the savior of our country. Like, I don't go down that path of the QAnon believers and, you know, this. For me personally, I'm not an extremist, but to clump everybody into that whole group is,
well, I think what I was doing, I was clumping the Proud Boys, the Patriot Prayer, the 3%ers. Those are sort of the people who are out there on the streets, basically looking for fights, basically, and looking to come into cities and stir things up and create chaos, basically.
Right, and I feel like nobody's listening to each other. So Proud Boys have denounced.
Well, I've had conversations with them, and they believe what I'm telling you. They believe that this is a. They believe that America is like an exceptional country. They believe that European culture is superior culture. They believe, by and large, that women should take a back seat. That's the Proud Boys for sure feel that way. That's what I'm mainly talking about is the Proud Boys
okay.
and their associates. So I think if you read some of the articles I was reading from here about white Christian nationalism, you can look up this article, White Christian Nationalism, The Deep Story Behind the Capital Insurrection, which I read earlier. You can find it on the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs at Georgetown University by Philip Gorski. I think that's a good one I would recommend.
Okay. I just feel like what I want to get out to people is that not all of us support Christian nationalism. I am a conservative Christian. I did vote for Trump. I don't think that he's a savior to our country. I believe in God. But that doesn't mean that I hate people. And
well, then I wasn't talking about you. I was talking about the other people, so you don't have to worry.
Well, no, because Antifa, I know you weren't, but in general, what's happening right now...
No, they're out there to combat the Proud Boys. They're out there to combat the Proud Boys and the Patriot Prayer and the 3%ers who are coming into Portland to continue to have these rallies.
The church that was attacked. I was with the church that was attacked on Saturday in Portland, two Saturdays ago, by Black Bloc. I was with that church. We were not with the Proud Boys, we were not with the 3%ers, and we were not with Patriot Prayer. Although people chose to come from each group, it was not associated with any of those groups, and Black Bloc came in and completely attacked the worship.
I don't know anything about that. That was being held outside, was it?
It was outside at the waterfront park.
Right.
Yeah. So I just
want people to
know the difference, to start understanding that there really is a rift between the two groups, but that we can't keep clumping people together. And in my reality, that's happening. That is happening a lot. Like, my group of people were called white supremacists at the Salem Kaiser School Board meeting.
Well, listen, I think we're probably not going to come to... What? What's that? Why are you laughing?
No, I'm laughing because we were called white supremacists at the Salem Kaiser School Board meeting by the group of
Well, you know, I think white supremacism is something that we may not even be conscious of. I'm not accusing you of that, but I think it's a, you know, that's why people hate that critical race theory, is because they think that it's calling everybody, saying everybody is a racist, et cetera. And I think people don't necessarily understand what unconscious racism means and what it means, what white supremacism actually means. It means it's an institutional cultural thing that, in a sense, all of us as white people participate in and have a certain amount of privilege. It doesn't talk about our subjective beliefs. It's basically a, you know, it's the way the country was founded, which, again, this article I talk about, White Christian Nationalism, the deep story, talks about going back to the Puritans at the very beginning. So I think it's, you know, if we both read that article, we might have something much more specific to talk about in terms of politics and ideology. But we have some other people. I appreciate you calling in, and I appreciate your, you know, taking the time to express your beliefs. But I think we should probably let other people have some airtime as well. So thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right. Looks like we have Marcos up on the stack, if you're still waiting. Hello?
Yes. Hello, Paul. Good morning.
Go ahead. Yeah, good morning.
I think a lot of the response to the events of this weekend could be summarized with Nike's corporate motto, "Just Do It," if you remember that.
How could I not? I live in Oregon.
So for me, "Just Do It" applies to a lot of things. It basically, it's an anti-intellectual statement. It's just, don't think about it, just do it. A lot of the opposition to the Proud Boys and the Patriot Prayer seems to be on automatic right now. That the idea is they show up, we fight them. So there's a lot of the same energy winds up on both sides.
So what's your political perspective?
3%ers and the Proud Boys and that bunch is, while they're being portrayed politically and ideologically, that seems to be an add-on. That their main motivation is conflict, is hyper-masculinity, toxic masculinity. They like to fight. They like the camaraderie of other guys that self-identify as warrior, he-men, bros. It's a cultural thing. It's an emotional thing. It's a sense of belonging. There was a quote that was attributed to Joey Gibson. If this is inaccurate, I hope Joey calls the program to correct this. Joey Gibson was alleged to have said, Antifa made us. We would have been just a bunch of guys with flags on a street corner, and nobody would have paid attention. There was a quote from Tiny this Sunday where he was saying, Tiny is a really large Patriot Prayer / Proud Boy. I'm not sure what his affiliation is now. He was arrested previously on an assault charge here in Portland, but he still shows up at these events. He was saying on Sunday, where's Antifa? Why aren't they here yet? He was impatient that Antifa hadn't arrived. When their rally was moved to Park Rose, it was originally intended for downtown at the Salomon Street fountain. Now, most of the opposition to this event was downtown. Only a small contingent, it seemed like a fraction of the actual people that showed up.
So let me just interrupt you and cut to the chase for me anyway, not maybe not for you, but so you think Antifa created January 6th, the insurrection then?
Absolutely not.
Well,
no, I didn't say anything.
Then this is an independent. This is something that's happening, that's a bigger than just the Antifa, Proud Boy, et cetera, clashes in Portland and elsewhere. It is a real thing. They didn't, you know, Antifa's are, and to deny that there's a political element, I think, is somewhat disingenuous. Because I've talked to those people early on when the first demonstrations were happening at Waterfront Park. I went around and talked to them. No, they believe in the initial framework that I set out. That's their ideology. That's their bedrock ideology, and they're threatened by the rise of, you know, multiculturalism, multi-ethnic society, the loss of their privileges, the loss of the loss of the dominance of their worldview. That's what they're threatened by.
Okay, let's just go with what you said. I wasn't trying to say that because January 6th involved a lot more than Proud Boys. It was mostly a MAGA event. And I'm not talking about MAGA people. I'm talking about
it's all part of the same milieu.
You can say that, but this, as your previous caller was saying, there are distinctions to be made.
I think those distinctions are less important than the broader framework that I'm putting out.
Okay.
But anyway, the point
I'm trying to make, if I could just wrap this up, because if you're tired of the call, I'll keep it short. There was a response to be made on Sunday. There was one of two ways to go. One way would be ignore them. Don't go to Park Rose. If you're going to be in opposition to them, stay at the original location of downtown. That's where most of the counter-protesters were. From a strategic point of view, that would make more sense. Why go to where your opponents are strong and already based? Why not stay where you're strong and have them come to you if that has to happen? If there has to be a confrontation, at least approach it from a point of strength where most of your people are massed downtown. So strategically, in my opinion, it was a huge mistake to go to where they were. If nobody had gone to where they were, what would have happened to their event? Well, it either would have been very boring. It would have been 50 guys just listening to each other talk in an empty lot. Or they would eventually come downtown, but it would have been a different situation because they would have been facing a much larger group. Now,
that's an ongoing debate that people have talked about on this show and others. That if you just don't show up, a lot of people have said that. It would be interesting if that was to happen. I mean, maybe someone could call and talk about instances where that did happen and what ensued after that. No, that's a valid perspective, but thanks for calling in and expressing that, and let's give room for a couple other callers. We got Wade on deck, and we only have less than ten, like maybe 5 minutes left. So go ahead, Wade, if you're still there.
Oh yeah, sorry, brother. I was listening to the radio, so I thought okay. I think everybody should have the right to do whatever little rally they want to. I am not for, but just this, that guy just took my point. So this is what I want to know. If you're against something, say when we have a peace rally, you don't get people having a war rally against us, right? Because they don't need one, because it's in the papers, it's on the news, it's everywhere. So, but I think it's just what he said. You're just giving them more attention.
Well, this is really interesting. We have a lot more callers. This seems to be. I usually don't get people expressing these perspectives to me. So it's really interesting. This seems to have sparked a nerve. People do counter anti-war rallies for sure. That happens quite often, actually. In fact, the Proud Boys do show up at other people's events and try to combat them. I think what you're saying is not necessarily accurate.
No, I'm saying if they do it, I wouldn't copy that bad behavior. I think it's dumb. Listen, your mom, all our moms told us, ignore them. They'll go away.
Well, it seems like they're not going away. In fact, they're just...
showing up and giving them all kinds of press. And I'm not against Antifa. I see where they think what they're doing is correct, but it's just violence and against violence is not helping.
Well, there's the argument that if people had stood up more when the Nazis were coming to power and when the Mussolini was coming to power. I mean, the problem is when you get this. It's almost like a demonic force that grows upon itself when unchecked. So
newspapers.
What's that?
When people believe what they read in the newspapers, they'll go along with the next clown that comes along.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling up.
Hey, can I just put a couple
minutes left? We do have a woman on deck, and I want to give her the last word here. Rachel is up next. Let's hear what you have to say.
Hey, Paul. My phone's doing a weird echo. I'm going to try to ignore it. So I was there on Sunday. And as far as identity, I'm a 54-year-old white woman. I've been an activist and an anarchist since I was 14, which is 40 years. And I've been thinking about this since the WTO, that I think it's really important to separate political beliefs from strategy, from tactics, because we get caught up a lot in what, you know, people call riot porn. I am not going to get involved in a street fight. I'm too small, too old. I can run fast, and that's what I'm going to do if someone attacks me. And there were people discharging firearms at us on Sunday, and that scared the heck out of me. But so I'm a radical, and I oppose fascism. And Antifa is a movement. It's not an organization. I don't identify as being part of Antifa because it does seem like people who identify as being part of it are there to engage in a direct and militant way with groups like the Proud Boys. I actually do agree in that respect with Kathy, who called in. I'm very interested in hearing why that person believed that people who identify as Antifa are not anti-fascist. Because as far as I can tell, those things are aligned. There are a lot of folks there who had attitudes that I didn't share, mostly, as has been said, younger male people who said, like, I'm here to kick some butt. I think I'm allowed to say that on the radio, and I don't necessarily agree with that. I'm hoping folks who live in Portland remember 2 years ago when the Proud Boys were coming to town and people decided to have a giant street party, which was very fun and greatly outnumbered the folks who were coming in, and that seemed like a tactic that was successful because it felt very positive. But again, I think, like, my understanding is this show is originally to talk about political beliefs, and we can really get distracted by talking about tactics and what an individual chooses to do in the heat of the moment, when they're scared, when they feel threatened. I didn't have my comments very prepared. Sorry, I just felt motivated.
No. That's all very... I wish you had called earlier and we could explore this a little deeper. One thing I just wanted to respond to, which it seems to me that there's a certain self-selection that's happening, that there does seem to be, the people who are most willing to engage in direct, hand-to-hand combat or trading pepper spray or flash bombs or whatever, we don't seem to have exactly the kind of larger response that was happening a couple years ago, and that does seem to be changing the dynamic. There's a certain kind of, the people who are more willing to directly engage seem to be the ones who are showing up more, which is unfortunate. Yes.
Yeah, I guess the other thing I want to say is I don't agree with everything that the other caller said. My so-called comrades, I'll say people who I probably generally believe with politically, but I may not share their tactics, and I may be 30 years older than them. I'm not scared of them, and if I were an innocent bystander, I wouldn't be scared of them, because I don't think that they're going to discharge firearms unnecessarily. And that is a huge escalation. I mean, the fact that folks have been bringing firearms, that does make me nervous, absolutely, because just open carrying is escalatory. But I think the mass media are drawing this parallel. And I mean, it's another thing of confusing political beliefs with tactics. And I spend so much of my time trying to explain to people that the fact that I'm an anarchist means that I don't agree with the dominator system of government. It doesn't mean that I like to break things. Breaking things has nothing to do with anarchism. And when the media say, anarchy broke out of the demonstration, kind of my joke is, oh, does that mean that everyone sat down and had a really long meeting? Because what anarchists actually do is make decisions by consensus in meetings that can take a really long time.
That's what.
Right, and Kat, it was interesting because Kathy was
breaking things does not make you an anarchist, and being an anarchist does not mean break things.
But there do come times when, you know, when there is a rising, seemingly, you know, it's still a minority, but it, you know, of people who are, you know, who are the street fighters like the Proud Boys and the 3% and stuff. But, you know, their goal is to create mayhem and to, you know, I don't know if they're gaining supporters. I mean, though they, you know, I guess the main support that was gained by that movement was gained under Trumpism. So you're totally right as far as the, you know, driven by political ideology is where we need to keep the focus, you know, which led to the, you know, the January 6th insurrection. Anyway, we only have like a minute left. I'll just give you the last word.
Oh, geez, that's a lot of pressure. I think I agree with Kathy that it's that whoever it was that said that we need more discussion of the political analysis of what's going on and why people are choosing, because there is a time. I mean, I'm nonviolent as a tactic, not as a philosophy, partly because I don't think I would survive serious violence.
Okay, well, I got to let you go on that note. Sorry, my apologies. Thank you for calling, Rachel. We are out of time, and apologies to Edie, who was on stack, got a call a little earlier. Thank you for everybody who called in. This has been an interesting conversation. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Thanks, Ty, for operating the board, and thanks to everybody for listening. Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
Are you a fan of the independent film news and interviews on The Film Show? Well, you won't want to miss the new and expanded Words and Pictures.